Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Today, my guest is Ralph Blumenthal. Before I bring him on, I have to remind you to subscribe to Forbidden Knowledge News on lbry.tv, our official backup channel. We're always available on all popular podcast platforms. And definitely check us out on Rockfin. It's where you get all our premium content. You can get our Forbidden Knowledge News Con that we just held. You can get last year's. You get all our regular shows and all the premium content from all the amazing content creators on Rockfin. Just click that link in the description or visit rockfin.com/FKN+. Finally, I want to tell you about how you can protect yourself from harmful EMF radiation. With EMF Harmonized, they offer protection from harmful electromagnetic frequencies from your phone, computer, tablet, or your routers. I have one on all of my devices. It's just a small disc, goes directly on all those devices. I've already noticed a major difference of not feeling as groggy, sleeping better at night, and having more energy during the day after spending hours in front of my computer or near my phone. You can also get their awesome bracelets, offer the same protection. And the products were created by a mechanical engineer with 3 decades of experience in EMFs and telecommunication. Just use the link below to check out what they have to offer and protect yourself today. Today I want to welcome Ralph Blumenthal. His bio is extremely extensive, so I had to condense it quite a bit. He is a distinguished lecturer at Barrett College in the City University of New York. He was an award-winning reporter for the New York Times from 1964 to 2009 and has written several books on organized crime and cultural history. He has recently contributed to articles to the New York Times and other publications, working from home on his Barrett Archives blog, An Adventure in Democracy, and given virtual talks on his new book, The Believer, Alien Encounters, Hard Science, and The Passion of John Mack. Since 2010, he has taught journalism in the summer program of Phillips Exeter Academy in Exeter, New Hampshire, and in 2010 was named a distinguished lecturer at Barrett College, where he taught journalism and currently oversees historic collections in the Newman Library Archives. Ralph, welcome. How are you doing today?
Thanks, Chris. Great to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. I've been looking forward to this. Today we're going to be, of course, discussing not only your book, The Believer, Alien Encounters, Hard Science, and The Passion of John Mack, but I want to get your thoughts and insights on the phenomenon and this kind of disclosure that appears to be occurring from the mainstream media lately. And first, definitely for me, you were one of the individuals that kind of kick-started this mainstream UFO interest, I believe, from the article, of course, in 2017. I'd really like to know what really got you interested in the UFO phenomenon to begin with.
Well, I read science fiction as a young man, as we all did in those years. Ray Bradbury, Isaac Asimov, that was a big part of our lives. It was pretty much fiction then, landing on Mars, landing on the moon. Today, it's an everyday occurrence almost. But over the years, I stepped away from that. I was not particularly interested in UFOs. I did my reporting for the Times, investigative reporting on very earthbound subjects like the mafia and police corruption and Nazi war criminals, etc. But in 2004, I became aware of John Mack and his books. I picked up a copy of his second book. I didn't know anything about him. And I thought I would maybe interview him. His book was Passport to the Cosmos. And right after that, he was run down and killed in London, looking the wrong way down a street, as happens to Americans in London. And then that really got me interested in 2004. So I started looking into John Mack. And it was really no connection to the Times story in 2017. That came up quite independently. When we heard about this secret Pentagon office investigating UFOs, ATIP. So it was really two separate things.
Right. Now, did you realize after the article came out in 2017, the impact that it would really have on, mainstream ufology in the media?
Not really. We thought it was big news because, the government was supposedly out of the UFO business with Blue Book in 1970, but actually they were still very interested. The higher you went up in the military, the more interested they were, I guess you could say, but it wasn't public. But we really had no idea what we were tapping into. We thought it was a good story. The Times put it on page one on a Sunday, so it attracted a lot of attention. But it really did seem to open the door to the kind of, you know, disclosure that's come since.
Yes, definitely so. Now, you know, you look at everything happening now, you know, we have last year the president ordering the 180 days for the release of these new documents. We've had the Oumuamua phenomenon that, you know, speculates that it could be some kind of probe. Of course, the Tic Tac incident and all these other things coming out, you know, recently in the past couple of years. Do you think this is going to be a trend that will continue into the next few years?
Well, it's pretty hard to put the genie back in the bottle. You know, there's a great public appetite for this. The public can be trusted, you know, with the truth. I think the public wants to know more. The government has a long history of being secretive about this and dissembling, sometimes putting out disinformation. But I think now, you know, actually the Navy has come a long way and the Pentagon. They are now encouraging people to come forward with these stories. So they realize there's a public interest in, you know, in being straightforward. Not everything, of course, a lot is still classified. Probably too much. But I think the door has been opened and it's going to be very hard to close.
Do you think it's strictly because of public interest or there's possibly other agendas behind the release of this information?
Well, you know, it's hard to generalize. I mean, there's many different agendas going on. Certainly there's a national security interest in keeping some of the stuff secret. We, the American government people, don't want our adversaries to know exactly what we know about this, you know, groundbreaking technology. There is a race going on to harness this technology, whatever it is. So there's a legitimate government interest. But I think, you know, more and more the people in the government realize that, you know, the public is clamoring for information. So much has come out already that is striking that we didn't know a few years ago. For example, now we know actually for a fact that these objects are physically real. We don't know where they are, but we, you know, we don't know where they come from. We don't know what they are, who's behind the wheel. But the idea that these are some spiritual, you know, fantastic things that, you know, are a creation of consciousness or whatever, that they're not physical, that's no longer the thinking. There are pictures of them. There's, you know, FLIR, thermal imaging. They're caught on radar. So they are real. Whatever they are, they're real.
Yeah, yeah, it is. It's very fascinating to see what's happening right now. Now, when it comes to your book, The Believer, you said, you know, you picked up an interest in John Mack. How long were you looking into Dr. John Mack before you really started writing the book?
Well, I started writing it, coming across his book in 2004. After he was run down, I got really interested in this story and I got access to his papers. The family gave me access to his archives, his journals, his analysis records. He taped everything. And I started that pretty much in 2004. So on and off, I've been working on it for 16 years. It's a long time.
Now, you said you had access to a lot of his own personal files and information. Could you talk a little bit what, you know, about what it was like to have access to that? And you worked closely with his family on the book as well?
I did. I mean, they gave me the access. I didn't work with them, you know, on a regular basis. They gave me interviews. John Mack left behind three sons. I interviewed his wife, Sally, shortly before she died of cancer. So I had access to members of the family who were really very helpful. But I'm glad to say they did not demand anything in exchange. They didn't demand any right of censorship. They didn't see the manuscript until the book was finished, and I sent it to them after it was published, and I was told that they liked it, which I was very happy to hear. But they, you know, I guess they had faith in me as a biographer that I could be trusted with this material, because a lot of it was very raw material from his papers. He recorded his innermost thoughts in his journals. He didn't censor himself. He He talked to his therapist about what was really on his mind, his concerns with the alien abduction phenomenon, his marital troubles because he was carrying on with some other women. He was always searching for something missing in the universe because of a traumatic event in his own childhood. So I got that, you know, picture of him that was really the best thing I could get short of speaking to him directly, and maybe even better, because if he'd been around, he might have said, you know, Ralph, don't use this, or I don't want you to do that, or stay away from this. So and you could say I had the best of all worlds. I had access to his material, and nobody was, you know, waving me off. Although I do miss the, I must say I missed the chance to have met him and talked to him, because he was a very brilliant guy.
Yeah, right. I can imagine. Now, for those that aren't really familiar on who John Mack was, could you give us a brief overview on, you know, a little bit about his background and eventually what he got involved with when it comes to the UFO abduction phenomenon?
Sure. So John Mack was a Harvard psychiatrist, very well regarded at Harvard, esteemed in his field. He had won a Pulitzer Prize writing about Lawrence of Arabia. He wrote a psychological biography, actually, of Lawrence of Arabia, who redid the map of the Middle East, very important figure, who became a kind of a role model to John Mack. So he had the Pulitzer Prize. He had a very distinguished career at Harvard. He had written a book on nightmares. So later on, you know, people couldn't say, you don't know what a nightmare is. You know, these people are not really being abducted. They're only suffering a nightmare. He could retort honestly, look, I do know what nightmares are. I've studied them. He wrote about childhood development. He wrote about aberrant states in psychiatry. So he was really very, very well educated. And but until he stumbled across the abduction phenomenon by a series of steps that I outline in my book, he was really quite conventional. He was a good psychiatrist, but he was not into, you know, paranormal things. And he was very devoted to social justice. He worked to bring mental health care to Cambridge Hospital, which was then a downtrodden part of Boston. He demonstrated against nuclear weapons because he felt that doctors should be, you know, worried about the future of the planet and keep people safe. He was involved in a lot of social causes. And then through a series of steps I outline in my book, he stumbled across abduction. And he was captivated by the abduction phenomenon. I like to say he wasn't captured, he was captivated, like I was captivated. And we can talk a little later about, you know, these steps, what it was that got him interested. But he was the least likely person to really take this on in the beginning.
Yeah, and when it comes to, you know, his work, he was also high when he started, you know, really getting into the UFO phenomenon. He was actually highly criticized by Harvard and many of his peers, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was very unconventional work for a Harvard psychiatrist. On the other hand, Harvard was no stranger to, you know, paranormal research, you know, anomalous research. William James, the father of psychology, had been attending seances and writing about that at Harvard 100 years before. But there was something about John Mack's approach that really turned off his superiors. He was very enthusiastic. He was naive. He sort of wasn't aware of the trouble he was stepping into, you know, with his peers who were, you know, quite conventional, many of them, and were dubious of what he was, you know, getting into. So he wasn't very political in the sense of, you know, judging what the pitfalls were. So and sure enough, Harvard convened a committee to investigate him. They were interested in his methods. You know, was he enabling these people? Was he planting these memories in people? And, you know, what were his billing methods? What was his finances? It was a very intrusive investigation that he overcame with the help of very good lawyers, and the fact that he really wasn't doing anything wrong that they could find, or that he did anything wrong at all. So in the end, he wasn't disciplined. He got a little tap on the wrist because they said he was too enthusiastic, and he agreed. He said, "Yeah, I was." You know, I have in my book the only and the first full story of this Harvard Inquisition, I call it, because that's a word they used at one point. Harvard never put out an official report. It was always a secret inquiry. And I pieced it together from legal memos in John Mack's files, emails and things like that, interviews. So, but Harvard never really explained what this was all about or how it came to its conclusions or whatever, but it's all in my book.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the steps that you mentioned that kind of brought him to where he got to with his research.
Okay. So, he was brought up in a very conventional German Jewish household. His parents were quite wealthy. His father, who, by the way, had been an English professor at the City College of New York when I was a student there. So I talk about this in my book. There's a whole series of synchronicities that intertwined me with the Mack story before I was even aware of it. So I was a student at City College. His father was a professor there. And young John was brought up in this very conventional household where his parents were not even particularly religious. It was very secular. They were not particularly spiritual. They were not superstitious. They were very well grounded in the academic world. So, as I said, he was sort of the least likely person to drift into this field. But what happened is, after he wrote his biography of Lawrence of Arabia, and he traveled the Middle East to work on peacekeeping missions between the Arabs and the Israelis, and met with Yasser Arafat, and then he demonstrated against nuclear weapons, he ended up going out to Esalen, which is that, you know, that psychic think tank on the Pacific with all the experiments and, you know, mind trips and drugs and cutting edge stuff. And he got involved in something called holotropic breathing, which is a discipline where you can, by controlling your breathing, you can change your levels of consciousness. You can actually go back to your early childhood, according to people who have done this. I haven't done it myself, but it's well talked, you know, documented and talked about. So he goes out there and he gets into this breathing group and breathing rhythmically to music. And he finds himself sort of carried back to his childhood. He's a baby in the womb. He remembers himself being born and his mother turning blue. And, you know, all these early memories, he seems to have some kind of memory of a previous life where he's a Russian peasant and his son is being, you know, beheaded by the Mongols. So he has all these strange experiences in the breathing. And then somebody there at Esalen gives him a book about alien abduction, which he sees for the first time, and he thinks it's kind of crazy. He doesn't believe it. And then a fellow psychiatrist at one of these breathing sessions says she has a patient who seems to have been abducted. And she knows somebody who's been researching this, an artist named Bud Hopkins, famous name in the field. And wouldn't John Mack like to meet him? And he still was resistant. He said, "That's crazy. You know, why would I want to meet Bud Hopkins? You know, I don't believe this stuff." So these are the steps that brought him to the threshold. And then, you know, we can talk about what happens after he meets Bud Hopkins, because that is really the transformative moment.
Yeah, let's definitely talk about that. I would have to agree with that.
Okay. So John Mack finds himself in New York in 1990. He's visiting his friend Bob Lifton, another famous psychiatrist who wrote about Nazi doctors, and he wrote about the survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, a very impressive guy. So John Mack is visiting Bob Lifton, and it turns out that Bob Lifton knew Bud Hopkins from Cape Cod, because Bud Hopkins was an artist on Cape Cod. And Robert Lifton, like all good psychiatrists, go to Cape Cod in the summer, which is why you can't get analyzed in the summer. So Bud Hopkins and knew Robert Lifton and vice versa. So John Mack says to Lifton while he's visiting Lifton in New York, hey, I got a chance to go over and meet Bud Hopkins. I'm not sure I should go. And would you like to come along? And at this point, Bob Lifton's wife pipes up, BJ, and she says something that really floored me when I heard it. She says to her husband, John has a choice about getting, John has no choice about getting involved in this, and you do. She says, wow. Right. So she's like, a psychic here. And sure enough, so John Mack goes off alone to meet Bud Hopkins, and she was right. He had no choice. As soon as he heard about the abduction phenomenon from Bud Hopkins, through letters Bud Hopkins gave him, he was hooked. And, and Bud Hopkins knew about this because he had seen a UFO early on in his time at Cape Cod. And he was on his way to a party and, they saw a UFO over the ocean, and he gets to the party and he tells the people at the party, hey, we just saw a UFO. And the people at the party say, oh, yeah, we've seen UFO. Oh, yeah, everybody had a UFO story. So Bud Hopkins said, man, maybe there's something to this. So he became kind of an expert, and he investigated, UFOs and alien abduction and the people who had stories about being, encountering aliens. So that's how he got into it. And he discovered the idea of missing time, that people would find themselves far away from their destination suddenly. They didn't know how they got there, or on a road that they didn't plan to take. And this was long before John Mack got involved. So Bud Hopkins was really a pioneer. So Bud Hopkins is telling John Mack this stuff, and John Mack is saying, well, maybe I'll look into it. So he collects his own group of experiencers, John does, and he's bowled over, by these stories. And so that's sort of the next stage. And then we could talk about what about these stories, really intrigued him.
Oh yeah, I definitely want to get to that. Now, before I do, there are some that speculate that John Mack's death was not accidental, and I'd like you to kind of clear that up for those that believe that it was some sort of conspiracy or something.
Yeah, well, rumors quickly spread when John was run down in 2004, just before his 75th birthday. There was a lot of rumors floating around that it was an assassination. It was a hit job. He had made quite a few enemies, obviously, with his controversial research. And, people are conspiratorial and they're always looking for some dark story, behind the story. But I had access to the police reports of the accident. I talked to, witnesses, people who went over later, members of his family, and I'm 100% convinced that it was just what they said it was. It was an accident. The driver was well known. He was basically a good man who had too much to drink. He was a charity worker, and John Mack stepped into the road right in front of his car. He really didn't have time to react. It was late at night. And John was very tired at that point. He'd been through a lot. People have speculated whether maybe he was ready for death, and he was at that point looking into after death experiences. So we can talk about later that, whether he was, complicit in his own death in some way, that he was, eager to carry on his research from the other side, as he told people. But anyway. But anyway, it was an accident, and there was nothing nefarious to it. So in my book, I really, put an end to that conspiratorial, theorizing.
Yeah. Well, tell us about some of those profound stories that really got, John working with Bud into this.
Okay. So John Mack, encountered these stories for the first time. As I said, he had no preconceived idea of whether they were true or not. They were certainly unbelievable, the stories, outlandish. As I say in my book, the very first page, I quote an English scientist, Sir William Crookes, himself, who was sent to debunk some paranormal events that he was witnessing, and then he came to believe them. He said, "I never said it was possible. I only said it was real." So that was sort of John Mack's introduction to these stories. He gathers these experiencers together, and he starts to interview them. Now, remember, he's a psychiatrist with a lot of experience, so he doesn't just interview them like a journalist might interview them. He interviews them from the standpoint of a professional who is used to evaluating states of mind. And he decided, based on his extensive knowledge of the human psyche, that these people were not crazy, that they were not deluded. They were not making up stories for fame. They were not hoaxing him, although there was one case later on where he was hoaxed. But by and large, the people who came to him were telling him stories that they certainly believed were true. And they were telling him before hypnosis. So in other words, consciously, stuff they remembered. And they were remembering these stories with suitable affect, which is the psychiatric term for the behavior that people exhibit. So in other words, if someone's telling a story of a trauma, do they exhibit the proper signs that they are really recounting a trauma, or are they making it up? And these people had the right affect. They were crying and they were screaming and they were cursing. And that convinced John Mack that they were not not making it up. So secondly, he found that the stories were basically consistent. People, see a UFO, they lose track of time. Later on, they remember, or through hypnosis, they remember that they were beamed through their walls or windows. They were taken to a craft, subject to some, strange pseudo-medical experiments by little figures, gray figures, not green, so-called grays, and taller doctor figures who sometimes extracted the eggs from women and the sperm from men, and later on these people remembered being abducted again and shown their children, their hybrid children. So that was the basic story that they were telling, and yet there were so many different details that could further convince John Mack that they weren't reading off some script, like this was the agreed upon story. There were enough, slight differences that made the stories, more authentic. Also, he noticed that, first of all, the phenomenon seemed to occur to people of different ages, men and women from different walks of life, professional people, cops, psychiatrists, professionals, as well as blue collar people, and sometimes children as young as 2 years old would tell a story, little man, take me up in the sky, I fly in the sky. So John Mack said, these kids are not reading books about, alien abduction, and they're not reciting things they saw in the movies. They're 2 years old. Some of them had marks on their bodies afterwards that they didn't remember having beforehand. In one case, it was a quadriplegic who had marks on his body. He could not have inflicted those, on himself. And sometimes the foliage and the ground was disturbed outside, where people remember a UFO landing. And sometimes there were even witnesses. Two people remembered the same experience. Or in one case, two girls were having a sleepover, and during the night, one of the mothers came down to check on the girls, and they were gone. And she called the police. She was terrified. They searched everywhere. They couldn't find them. And a few hours later, the girls turned up back in their beds. No explanation. So John Mack put all these stories together, and he said, something is happening to these people. It may It may not be happening in everyday reality in front of us. You know, it's not on, it's not being photographed. It's not, you know, it's not something we can document. And yet all the other explanations are eliminated. So that's what we're left with. Something real is happening to these people on some dimensional plane. So that's how convinced he was.
Yeah, that's really cool. Now, what you mentioned, he, you know, he did dream studies. What other unusual or studies or practices did he get into besides, you know, ufology?
Well, you know, it's interesting you mentioned the dream studies, because some people, skeptics, have come forward and said, well, you know, it's clear this is sleep paralysis. This is a well-known phenomenon where people feel themselves paralyzed at night. Well, first of all, quite a number of these experiences didn't happen at night. They happened in the daytime. In one case, a woman was driving a snowmobile when she was, you know, she felt herself abducted. People are driving, like Betty and Barney Hill, the famous case in New Hampshire, where they were driving. So it's not always at night. So there, you know, there goes that theory. So people have had, you know, various explanations, but none of them fit. John Mack always said that if somebody could come up with a good scenario, good, you know, alternate explanation, I'd like to hear it. So that's something to remember. Now, as you say, he did move on into other fields of paranormal activity. He got very interested in crop circles. He went to England to investigate these strange formations burned or somehow impressed on the grass and the wheat fields in a particular part of England. And he lay down in one of these and felt tremendous energy. So that's one of the areas of that he also investigated. He was interested in a wide range of experiences. He began to realize that alien abduction is not something by itself completely. It has counterparts in other abnormal experiences, such as sightings of Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster, and you know, precognition, and all the other remote viewing. I mean, there's a whole range of things that are not easily explainable by the, you know, three or four dimensions that we're familiar with. And in the end, he was particularly interested in survival of consciousness, life after death. What happens after we die? I mean, when you think of it, the two biggest mysteries in creation are we alone? You know, is there other intelligent life in the universe? And what happens after we die? Those are the two big questions. So he was involved in the first, like, are we alone? Is this, you know, some other intelligence out there? And then what happens after we die? That's even a bigger question, because that affects everybody, you know. He started to look into that when he himself was killed.
Now, I know he looked into he must have looked into this a bit, but do you know how extensive he looked into the types of communication that were involved during these abduction experiences? I know most report some type of psychic communication, you know, telepathy or something like that. Did he do much research into that?
Yeah, he asked all his people. I should say that he wrote two books, the second one of which got me started. But his first book was called Abduction: Human Encounters with Aliens. He wrote that came out in 1994. And it was 13 case studies of people he interviewed at great length. He didn't give their names, but some of them became public afterwards. So I know who a lot of them are, and I've talked to some of them myself. And the stories that all of them told, really, were that these beings, when they materialized, communicated telepathically. Because the first question everybody asks is, well, what do you mean? They speak good English? I mean, they speak all these languages, you know, where they go to language school in the cosmos. And the people said, no, they don't speak English, but the words just sort of popped into my head, what they were saying. So they communicated somehow telepathically, maybe through their eyes, huge black almond-shaped eyes, wraparound eyes that were very disturbing to people, very magnetic, hypnotic eyes that seemed to communicate telepathically these messages that popped into the brains of people. So that was interesting. That came up in just about all the stories. And nobody said that they had a normal conversation with these beings, or at least very, very few ever said that. They all said the words popped into my head and they seemed to know what I was thinking. So he did investigate that. And that's one of the, features, stories he tells in his book.
Yeah, one of the very interesting aspects for me is the possible interdimensional aspect. I mean, you even mentioned earlier how he wrote about, people being taken through their walls or through their roofs. They'll have strange memories, screen memories of, something else besides these little gray beings, and then they'll remember it later. Other things where they'll be taken on a ship, but the ship is inside much larger in appearance than it appeared on the outside. All these strange oddities. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think this could be some sort of interdimensional phenomenon that's not necessarily in our spectrum of vision when it occurs?
Yeah, it does seem. Certainly, these experiences are not visible to people who are not part of it. In some cases, as I said, there are witnesses. It happens to two people at the same time. But by and large, these things are not happening in an everyday reality where they're visible to the public at large. These ships appear and disappear, very mysteriously. John Mack did come to feel that there was some dimensional aspect here where they would penetrate our dimension, but not really be part of our dimension. And, I'm remembering one story that one of his experiencers told him that I found very telling. She said, people always think that these ships come from a great distance away. And, how do they travel such a great, the cosmos is so large and light years away. How do they travel? And she said, she being an experiencer said, I have the feeling that because space is curved it curves in on itself. And what seems to be, or what would otherwise be far away, is really bent over to be right next to us. So this dimension is existing parallel to our dimension, and therefore it's not a great distance. It can penetrate our reality. Now, this was just her theory, but it made some sense because it would explain why these things, materialize and disappear so readily, and the beings suddenly materialize in someone's bedroom, and then they disappear. So that's an aspect of it. And John, there were people like Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs, who was another member of their, research circle, a former professor at Temple, who did a lot of research in UFOs and a lot of writing about abduction. He and Bud Hopkins believed that these abductions were happening in real time in our reality. That was a big difference between them and John Mack. John Mack thought it's got to be happening in some other dimension that penetrates our dimension, but not in everyday reality because we don't see it and we can't document it. But anyway, so that was a big difference. But clearly he thought that there was some dimensionality involved that we don't understand.
Now, what do you think that these intentions of these beings were, and what were Dr. Mack's thoughts? Because we have, we have different, it seems, agendas from some of these different beings. We have hybrid, hybrid experiments. We have some that are giving us warnings about the future of our planet. We had some negative experiences. People have positive experiences. What were the conclusions for the intentions of these beings that he came up with?
Well, you're absolutely right that different researchers came up with different approaches or different theories, really. Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs were much more attached to the idea that these beings were basically evil. They had an agenda to take our DNA, to create a hybrid race. They didn't care how much they were tormenting humanity. People who were taken were completely traumatized. The beings didn't care. They were studying. They were studying us like lab rats. You know, they didn't care. But John thought that there was another aspect to these abductions. He heard from people that they felt transformed afterwards. They were more spiritual, more religious, more concerned with the fate of the earth. They actually developed, in some cases, a loving relationship with these beings. They looked forward to the encounters, and they developed more of an appreciation of a deity, a god, or a source. So there was something transformative and positive and beneficial to these encounters, which Hopkins and Jacobs basically disagreed with. So there were very different, conclusions as to what this agenda was. Now, remember that these beings were supposedly abducting people all the time and subjecting them to the same reproductive experiments time after time. So the question has been asked, well, they must be very bad scientists if they have to do the same experiment over and over again. I mean, and reproduction is not that hard to figure out. Somebody told me for my book, get a hygiene manual. You'll see it all explained. You don't have to, keep abducting people. So when they asked John Mack about that, he had a good answer. He said, I'm very bad on alien psychology. He says, I cannot explain why they do certain things, And that's, I think, a good answer, because the whole thing is so unexplainable. How could you begin to explain why, in the Ariel School case, where a school in Zimbabwe was visited, apparently, by a UFO and two small beings and 60 kids saw it, but no adults were present. They were all tied up, but the kids are at recess. So how come the aliens figured out the exact moment when there would be no adults there? And again, John Mack says, I don't know what their psychology was. Did they figure it out? Was it an accident? I mean, so those questions are unanswered and probably unanswerable.
Yeah, you mentioned the Ariel School. That's one of my favorite cases. And Dr. Mack actually went out and interviewed some of the kids there. I'm wondering, do you know about what his thoughts were on why there are so many of these similarities between these school sightings where these entities will go and they'll find the children where no adults are around and, have conversations with them or interact with them in some way? And there's very similar cases to that Ariel school phenomenon.
Yeah, it really is extraordinary. I mean, I'm most familiar with the Ariel case because I don't know too many of the others. But in that case, that is probably one of the best, if not the best, documented cases of encounters, because children, again, who were not exposed to cultural influences, particularly, they couldn't say, oh, they read it in a book, or, they saw movies about it. They just came running in later and said, and dozens of them said the same thing, that they saw colored lights in the sky. They saw a ship landing. They described it. They drew pictures of it. They saw two little beings come out. Short, and they described them with these dark, rugby ball eyes, they called them. To us, it would be a football. The beings were communicating with the children, telling them that they should be good stewards of the earth, and they felt the beings were sort of communicated a loneliness, a sadness about them. All these messages the kids got. And they were, basically the same. The kids, corroborated each other's stories. They drew pictures of it afterwards. And because there were so many of these kids, 60 of them, who saw the same thing, basically, the stories had a really heavy weight. And afterwards, these kids who were then, this happened in 1995 or so, I guess.
Yeah, I think
around
that's
then.
Somewhere around there.
Yeah, so now they're grown up and they still remember these things, and they're giving interviews and they're talking about it. It has shaped their lives, transformed their lives. They remember this to this day. So it's an extraordinary story. And John Mack did go there with his partner at the time, Dominique, and they talked to these kids. And John, you could see his interviewing technique because he kept the tapes. He was very solicitous of these children, why he was such a good psychiatrist. He really literally got down on their level, got down on the floor to talk to them. And he was very persuasive and non-threatening. And he didn't lead them, you know, to make them say something they didn't want to say. He just asked these questions, and it makes for very compelling watching.
Yes, it definitely does. Now, for the last few minutes we have, I'd like to get your thoughts on some of the modern, I guess, things that are going on in the mainstream with disclosure, starting with the announcement from the Israeli space commander saying that, yeah, there's a galactic federation and our government knows about it and all this crazy stuff that he said. I'd like to get your thoughts on that.
Well, you know, there's stuff and there's stuff. You know, if you tell me, first of all, he came with some credibility because he's an Israeli defense expert, and you think, well, he must know a lot about, you know, defense and space. But if he says that the Americans, you know, have a secret base on the moon, all I can say is it took a tremendous effort to land a man on the moon. It hasn't happened very often in history. And if a base was established on the moon, I think we'd know about it. First of all, I don't think that's something you can keep secret. So I'm really very dubious of that. It is a crazy world of stories, but some of the stories are just purely anecdotal. And they say, I encountered this and there's no way to check that, really, short of, the person have marks on his body or her body afterwards or whatever. But when someone says that there's a big technological breakthrough and that alien beings are working with, you know, the defense attachés on secret projects, that requires a lot more backup to accept. So, you know, and the MJ-12 thing, and there's a secret committee of aliens working with, you know, American defense experts. I don't put much credence in that.
So what about that there are factions of our government or military that may have already reverse engineered craft or vehicles and or exotic materials and have been working with this stuff for a while, and that a lot of the UFOs we see are actually our own? What do you think about that?
Okay, so that's a very intriguing area of interest, obviously. We looked into that at the New York Times in our last story, reported on as far as we could on materials. We got as far as being able to say that congressional committees were briefed on some matters involving reported materials that had been recovered. That's all we were able to say. This area is highly classified, which means we cannot get access to information. And we at the Times are not about to get thrown in jail for revealing classified information, even if we could get it. I mean, this is a very sensitive area. And the other stories we did, the December 17 story about the secret Pentagon effort, ATIP, to investigate UFO, that was unclassified. So we, in the Navy videos that we got released of showing Navy encounters with these objects, those are unclassified. So we don't traffic in classified material. But the issue of materials is classified, whether they exist or not, and I'm not prejudging it. There are stories that the government has and defense contractors have gotten access to materials from crashed objects and they're reverse engineering them, et cetera, et cetera. I can't confirm that. There's a big lid on that. It's, as I say, the whole area is classified. There may or may not be something to it. I mean, there's the whole Bob Lazar story that he worked on reverse engineering a UFO. He saw the UFO. We have not been able to verify that. That's very, very difficult. And that requires a really very very detailed documentation before you can say that that's true or not. You know, you have to be very, very careful. People on the internet and bloggers can get away with a lot and speculation and, you know, but when in the New York Times and the way I operate, you've got to really document what you're saying. And we did that with every story we did so far. The objects are real. We don't know what they are. That part we can confirm. We've confirmed it. But do we have materials from those? Are we reverse engineering those? I don't know. There's intriguing stories, but nothing that I think has held up so far to an independent observer.
What about the story that came out yesterday about the newest Pentagon release video of the Triangle UFO taken by the Navy personnel in 2019? What about that? What do you think about that footage?
Yeah, we're aware of those stories, and the people who got that leak are credible. The images, you know, the Pentagon, the Defense Department has basically verified that those are legitimate images that were taken from a fleet of a battle carrier group in 2019 on the West Coast. They still don't know what these objects are. You know, they've been photographed. They're very intriguing triangle shape, as you say. It's some of the best footage we've ever seen of, Navy footage of an object. And it's probably the best image of a triangle shape. But again, nobody knows what they are. And they were referred to in official accounts as drones. Drones is the word that keeps coming up. We don't have drones like that. The United States, we don't think, people we've spoken to don't think the Chinese or the Russians or any other earthly power have drones like that, that can stay up that long. That doesn't mean they can't be adversarial. But the best people we've spoken to say they would be very surprised. They don't think that that's possible. So what does that leave? If they're not ours and they're not Russian and Chinese, well, what are they? Well, no one is taking that next step to say that. The people in the Defense Department are very cautious. And when you ask them, they will always go back to the same thing. Well, we're studying it. We don't know. That's what the UAP report is supposed to illuminate if it ever comes out. Probably won't come out on time. Some of it, a lot of it will probably be classified. But what they keep saying is that these are unidentified objects. They're not saying they're off Earth, although that may be the obvious conclusion. If they're not ours and not theirs, you know, Russian, Chinese, what else are they? But no one would say.
Right. Any ideas on what we have to look forward to with this 180-day information dump that's coming up?
Well, fixate on the 180 days because that ain't going to happen. 180 days was the deadline put in to the Defense Authorization Act when it passed in December, that they're supposed to report, the UAP task force is supposed to report to the public, to the Senate Intelligence Committee and the public within 180 days, but we hear quite reliably that it's taking longer. There's more material to deal with than they can process in 180 days. So in other words, instead of June, it's going to be later than June, and they need more time, which they can always get. This is not a statutory deadline where they are penalized if they don't come in on time. They with serious things like this, they often say, we just need more time. It's okay, you got more time. So everything we've heard is that it's going to be delayed and delayed for a reason, that there's so much material to process that the investigators have to go to all these corners of the government to try to figure out which secret agency is controlling what data. They have to get access to it. It has to, people need high level clearances to get access to that. And then when they have it all, how much is going to be made public? How much is going to be classified? I think, there'll probably be a classified part that will only be given to, closely held to certain people in the Congress. And then there'll be a public part. How interesting will the public part be? Will it be stuff we already know? I don't know. But Don't count on your fingers 180 days and say this is the day it'll be released.
Right, yeah, I would have to agree that people shouldn't cross their fingers on that one. Well, Ralph, thank you so much for coming on tonight. That was fantastic information. The best way for people to find your book, The Believer, that'd be on Amazon, right?
Well, Amazon for sure, Barnes & Noble. I like to recommend people go to independent bookstores because they need all the help they can get. Amazon's got enough money, although they've been nice to me. But go to an independent bookstore. Or if you want to read it right away, you get a Kindle version. You can have it instantly. A lot of the information is on my website, www.ralphblumenthal.com, RALPHBLUMENTHAL.com. I have the links there, a little bio of me, stories of other appearances I've made, etc. So, but it's easy to get the book. And if they're sold out in one place, sometimes Amazon sells out here or there. It's restocked pretty quickly and other places have it.
Awesome. Sounds great. Ralph, thank you again for coming on tonight. That was fantastic information. I'd love to talk to you again in the future.
Chris, thank you so much. A real pleasure.
Great. And till next time, everyone, have an excellent evening.